But first up, we're talking disease in Ireland, and I'm delighted to welcome, as I said, Dr. Aoife McCormack, and a PhD, is it? Postdoc?
Yes, PhD
student, Daniel Kirby. Welcome to the show.
How's it going?
Right, we'll start with Aoife. Aoife, you're involved in education and outreach, so I suppose...
Yes. The
Biomedical Diagnostics Institute, it's something to do with disease, and it's based at DCU and a few other places.
Sure, what yeah. It's basically, we're funded by SFI. We're a research institute that really have a focus on creating new diagnostic devices, so particularly around point of care, which means kind of non-invasive, you know, rapid results. And in particular, we are looking at kind of things like cancer and cardiovascular disease and new ways of diagnosing and monitoring them.
Okay, yeah, and you released some videos there as part of the Dublin City of Science, the big thing that was on in Conference Centre in July, but it's still ongoing. I suppose it's trying to get a bit of awareness about what you do there. I thought the videos were great.
Thank you.
Yeah, because they looked at four of the biggies that we've had in Irish history. We'll talk a little bit about each of them. We had the plague, the Black Death, going back to the 14th century. Then we had the potato blight, which was a disease, obviously, it wasn't a human disease, but it affected humans.
Yeah.
And then we had the flu just after World War One, which was devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people may remember we had the TB in the 1950s.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That's not that long ago at all.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll do them in kind of chronological order.
Sounds
okay.
Good.
So the plague, right? Tell us, what is this plague?
So the plague, or the Black Death, it's very interesting. There's been lots of incidences of it throughout the kind of centuries. And, you know, basically back in the kind of 1347, 1348, there was a big, I suppose, pandemic of the plague that was worldwide. It spread from China. It's likely it originated in China and spread across Europe, and it really, you know, devastated Europe. It's estimated that, I think, you know, millions of people died. It's hard to say because it was so long ago, but it did come to Ireland, and we do know a little bit about it because there was a monk, Friar John Clinton, who wrote about it. So we know that it arrived in Ireland, you know, through the port towns and spread that way.
Yeah.
And just to, you know, of course they didn't know at the time what it was, but we do know now that it's caused by a bacterial infection called Yersinia pestis.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about this bacteria is it grows in a certain type of flea that affects rats, and that's how it's transported. It would kind of, you know, be on the actual rats that would travel in ships. So that's how it spread so easily.
So the flea got on the rats and got on the ships who got over over to Ireland eventually.
Yeah, and lived with the humans, you know, and that's how it, you know.
I wonder, in those days, did they have, like, obviously they didn't have great communications, we're talking 14th century, but their word must have got out that this thing was spreading all over Europe.
I think so. I mean, it's, and certainly there was a lot of kind of alarm and panic about it, and it seemed to be that, you know, some people thought it was, you know, a judgment from God, and there was people that used to go around kind of beating themselves because they thought it would kind of, you know, it would prevent them from getting the plague. And certainly I know that in Ireland in particular, that monk I mentioned, John Clynn, he certainly would hear from messengers, you know, he almost documents it moving down south. He was based in Kilkenny.
Right.
And he would kind of, if you look at his annals, he talks a little bit about, oh, that, you know, there was deaths at this particular town, and you can almost see it moving towards
them,
you know.
Scary stuff, yeah.
Very scary stuff,
and
you know.
It would have come in the port towns, Dublin and...
kind of
Hoth,
Drogheda, Waterford,
Hoth.
Yall.
Oh, is that level of detail, yeah.
Yeah, he says, I think he mentions Hoth and Drogheda certainly in his details, and also in Waterford, Yall, he would mention them as well, you know.
Yeah, and the symptoms are horrific, aren't they?
Yeah, not pleasant. There's a few different forms, basically, so there's kind of, you know, you can have headaches, kind of spitting blood, of course the classic kind of blackening of the skin, which is kind of due to kind of skin death. Also some people would kind of be turned, you know, because of the pain and the absolute infection of it, you would actually end up, you know, being a little bit mad or a little bit kind of, you know, delirious as part of it. So very, very unpleasant way to die, you know.
And what happened at the end of it, for some reason then, with a lot of diseases, a lot of people died, but some survived.
Yeah.
Why did some survive and others?
Some survive. It's an interesting question. I mean, and it could be due to kind of immunity, just the immunity of that particular person, or maybe they didn't get it up as bad, or it could be that maybe somebody might have been a little bit more looked after, you know, then, so they might have had a stronger kind of system and just be able to throw it off.
Yeah.
But it really had quite a high mortality rate. I think for one particular type of plague, it nearly has like an 80%, I think, mortality rate of if you get infected. So it was probably pretty unlikely, and especially, I mean, we can cure it now with antibiotics. There are still instances of plague these days.
Really?
In the States is really? One of them of, you know, of the places. But we can actually cure that these days.
Yeah,
you know?
And I believe, like, I think I read somewhere that people fled from the towns because they kind of realised that these are the dangerous places to be. So they didn't understand the science, but they could see what was happening.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think that was it. And I mean, you can even see that in some of the documents going back. They released some of the old Chancery documents there quite recently, and from that era. And you can see that, you know, things like business transactions have been cancelled because of due to the pestilence. Usually it has a quote in there. There's definitely, Dublin seems to have been pretty much, you know, very quiet and emptied at one stage, you know.
We could have a whole programme devoted to each of these.
Yes, sorry.
Sure.
We'll
move on. Blight. Okay, the Great Famine, that was due to blight. What's the cause of blight?
So it's actually a fungus that causes it. And basically it just makes the potato crop useless. It turns them to these awful, stinking, blackened fields. And it doesn't kind of... the potato, I think the poor people at the time, they did try and cook this kind of blackened, you know, mess, but it just was of no... It just fell to bits and it was of no use. And of course, you know, due to complex reasons, the people were very dependent on the potato crop at that time.
And interestingly, what you show in your videos, that people, they didn't have a clue what was causing it.
No.
But they linked it to technology as well. The railroads and all kinds of...
I think the locomotives, as they called it, they were kind of new at the time, and they, you know, anything new, of course, is probably likely to be a suspect in these things, but they thought it might have been something to do with that. And of course there was that theme of it being a judgment from God as well, you know.
That seems to be there with a lot of these things.
There is a little bit of that.
Were there serious efforts at the time to try and deal with it? Or
I think scientifically I think it's complicated. I'm not sure exactly what they could do. I think they were really kind of quite baffled as to what it was. I think there were some attempts, because it certainly wasn't, you know, the only place that had blight, you know.
Yeah.
I believe there was a vicar in London who actually did kind of... I think he was based in London anyway, but he actually did make some sort of link. He was a keen gardener, I believe, and he made some sort of link between, you know, that it was passed. It was some sort of, you know, like an infectious agent, but I think nobody really listened to him, or nothing ever came of it.
The thing that caused it, this Phytophthora infestans, that's like it's got little tentacles and it would suck out a lot of the nutrients out of the potato.
It's just like a fungus. If you ever see a kind of fungus, say on an old tree trunk or something, you can see that it's kind of, it leaches off it almost. So it just, you know, reduced them to nothing. And one of the interesting things actually is that probably not a lot of people know, but the work that finally figured out the life cycle of the fungus was actually done out in Albert College, which is where DCU is now.
Okay.
Which is very interesting. So
one of your guys.
At the time it was the Agricultural Institute, Prince Albert Agricultural Institute. But he won the Boyle Medal for it actually, but he actually figured out what it was, and it led to, you know, being able to control it later on. It was kind of the 1920s.
If you know how the full life cycle from all aspects, you pick the weakest link, don't you, to try and attack it?
Yeah, usually. Yeah. I mean, I think they had some sort of... I can't remember the exact agent that they, you know, they used to control it after that, but I think they were able to kind of figure that out.
Okay, there's an Irish guy there involved in that one.
Yeah,
now moving on, the flu. Okay, we had just some figures here which are incredible. So we had World War One, it finished in 1918, and they reckoned that there were, let's see if I got this right, there were 37 million deaths from that, casualties, civilian, military, etc. Then along comes this flu, In 1918, just at the end of the war. They think the troubles are over. And then between 50 and 100 million are wiped out, which is 5% of the world's population.
Yeah, it's
so far more people
figure.
Died there as a result of that.
Yeah, I think the thing about this flu is that it was really, I think it almost came out of nowhere and it just completely stunned the population and the medical community at the time. And it's a huge figure. The thing about this particular strain of flu was that it actually kind of more preyed on the young and the healthy. So it kind of turned people's immunity against. It's this kind of process, within your body that can happen called a cytokine storm. It just means that your immunity is kind of turned against yourself and actually acts against
your
body.
Is that an autoimmune? Is that a disease that attacks yourself?
It's actually the flu itself, of course, is a virus, but it's basically the reaction of your body to this particular virus just kind of completely, it does overreact as such. And it just, and it was the young kind of healthy people that really got affected by it. So it was very dramatic and the medical community were really stumped with it.
Now tell us quickly, there was a connection with Dublin and somebody called Dr. Catherine Lynn.
Kathleen Lynn. Yes, she actually, her journal, you can just see how kind of shocked she is from it. And basically she is set up the first kind of fever ward, which led to it being a kind of mother and child hospital for poorer people
on
later
Charlemagne
on.
Street.
So Charlemagne Street, St. Dalton's. Yeah,
okay.
That's it. So she kind of would have been instrumental in setting that up just because she couldn't believe, in her journal you can see how she's, there's children dying around me, and she just seemed to be overwhelmed. So she said, "I have to do something about it."
And she did it.
She did it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, just finally, just sorry to rush you, but 1950s, then, not so long ago compared to the other ones, anyway. TB, and we all know the story about sanatoriums, and people might have grandparents or uncles or whatever that were affected. What's it caused by first?
So it's actually a bacterial infection as well. Now it can be complex. There can be a kind of group of bacteria that will do it, but in particular it's a bacterial infection, and it usually will attack the lungs and cause, the cavities and the classic kind of, coughing and blood, that you would probably know the symptoms of that. And it was infectious, but even at the time there was a big social stigma attached to it. They thought it ran in families and
are linked with the poor.
Yeah, pretty much. It was always that to be consumptive was to be quite shameful.
Now, sorry to rush you again, but Dr. Vincent Barry, tell us about him.
He was actually in Trinity and College in Dublin, and he was a chemist who was actually working on tuberculosis, a cure for tuberculosis. So he made all these different chemical compounds, but one of them in particular, it actually turned out to be effective against leprosy, which is actually kind of related to TB in a way. They have some, they're from the same kind of family of bacteria, and it actually, they recommend, it's called clofazamine, this particular drug, but they think that it was instrumental in kind of, curing leprosy. And they reckon there's estimations that at least 15 million people's lives probably have been saved since since the 1950s.
So an Irishman saved 15 million possible
people.
In doing science as a career, if you get into this particular area, you can literally change the world. Mm-hmm. And we have Daniel, I should have your second name here in front of me. Daniel Kirby's a PhD student at the Biomedical Diagnostics Institute. Have I got that right?
You have indeed.
Yeah, at DCU. So you're in the front line now of battling diseases of today.
Yes.
So what do you do exactly?
Well, what I work on is two of the biggest diseases today are cancer and cardiovascular disease, which kill people. So I'm working on cancer. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to come up with new ways of detecting cancer and monitoring the disease and basically being able to find it early so that it can be cured. And what I'm working on is a technology where we can take a blood sample and try and detect cancer from it. Because at the moment there's no way of detecting cancer really in that sort of area. What happens is you get a pain and you go to the doctor and they give you a scan and they see a tumor. So often at that stage it can be too late. So what we're trying to do is if you have a tumor in your body, certain cells will break off that tumor and they'll start to circulate in the blood. So what we want to try and do is try and find them. But the reason why they're so difficult to find is because there could be a background of maybe up to a billion blood cells and maybe one tumour cell. So that's where the hard part is. So we have to try and come up with technologies where we can find these very hard to find cells.
Wow, that's amazing, because that'd be such a breakthrough, wouldn't it? So you could, you wouldn't screen the whole population,
no,
would you?
Or
take a blood sample from people that you suspect might be at risk. Is that how you do it?
Yeah, exactly. If it got to the stage where it could actually be used, the way we look at it is we try and make devices that are a point of care, which Aoife mentioned, which means you could have it in a doctor's office. Like you wouldn't have to send away samples to a lab miles and miles away, and you know, that would be very expensive. So we try and make these devices, but we try and make them so that they're actually usable. They're not going to cost $500,000 or something to make them. So the thinking would be, either you could screen people that would be susceptible to risk, or if someone has had cancer and they've gone in for treatment and they think they're cured, it can often come back again. So
yes,
you could then send them in for a checkup maybe every month, where they just take a blood sample and take a look.
So monitor how you're doing, whether it's coming
back
or not.
But yeah, it's a very difficult thing to do. So that's what we're trying to do at the moment, trying to work out all the technology. So there's an awful lot comes into it. My background is I'm a physicist, so I work with magnets to try and take them up magnetically. So there's a, if I had a bit more time, I could probably go into it in more depth.
Yeah,
but basically what we try to do is we try to tag the cancer cells with iron particles.
Okay.
So then we can use a magnet to pull them out. So all the blood will flush by, and if there's any cancer cells, we can pull them out with a magnet and then try and detect them.
Is it kind of like a sieve? If they get caught in the sieve a little bit, or
it's no, almost like that. Basically, we can coat these iron particles that are absolutely tiny. They're nanoparticles, and we can coat them with a specific substance that will only stick to these cancer cells.
So everything else goes through and they're held.
Exactly, they're held. And then, but the hard thing is, if it was as easy as a sieve, you would have stuff clogging. Because if you think of a billion cells, so it's like, say, if you take all the people in China and you cover one guy in Velcro and you try and send them through an archway, and you're going to try and stick onto them. So it's kind of a similar thing.
Yeah,
so
I know what you mean.
There's lots of little tricks we try to come up with to figure it out. So it's a work in progress, but hopefully you can.
Brilliant. Yeah, and I presume nobody has done this yet.
Nobody
has a blood test for cancer yet, do they?
No, it doesn't really. There's a few technologies. There is one place in the States that have developed a technology that works in it, but it's incredibly expensive, and a lot of people say that it's not very efficient and it doesn't actually really work. So it was kind of a first step. So we kind of use that as a benchmark, and we try to come up with something that doesn't cost $500,000 and actually works well. So that's what
we're
trying
to do. Well, you've won a prize, I believe, so I'll be expecting you back here in let's see, 2 years' time, and you've got this thing sorted.
Ah, we'll see. Yeah. Jeez, I'll be flying down. If I can get it done by the end of the PhD, I'll be flying.
Did you mention also cardiovascular? Because that's heart disease. That's a huge thing as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. Cardiovascular disease is big. There's two big programs in the BDI. Now, there's one, the oncology program, which I work on, the cancer, then the cardiovascular disease. Maybe Aoife would be better suited to talk about cardiovascular.
Sure. I mean, we kind of would look at a little bit of, you know, things like blood coagulation monitoring. So, you know, there people who might be at risk of cardiovascular disease would get screened for that. And it's really looking at things like platelets and what effect this has on your platelets, and trying to monitor it that way. And again, also trying to develop this way of, you know, kind of non-invasively being able to monitor someone so they don't have to keep going back for all sorts of tests and you know, biopsies and things like
and
that.
And so I suppose, to sum up the whole area, you're trying to diagnose things earlier and get in earlier, and then monitor afterwards, make sure the disease is gone.
Absolutely.
That's
it's a fascinating area, and thank you very much for coming in. That's Aoife McCormack, Dr. Aoife McCormack, and Daniel Kirby. They're based at the Biomedical Diagnostics Institute in DCU, which is also based in other places and funded by SFI.
Sure.
Right, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thanks.